still, trying to catch up.
"I'm sorry, but I cannot do this," Carol continued. "Maybe if it was a girl, but a boy should be with his father. He should be with Mick."
June felt a breath escape her chest. She gasped for air, making a barely audible yelp.
"His birth certificate,"
the woman said, ignoring June's reaction and pulling the paper out of her black pocketbook.
"Here, his name is Hudson Riva."
She had named the child after herself, but would leave him all the same.
"Hudson, I'm sorry,"
Carol said, and then she turned and walked away. June watched the back of her, listened as the woman's black pumps clicked faintly on the pavement. Rage began to take hold in June's heart as she watched the woman run down her steps. She was not yet angry at Mick, though that would come, and not angry at the situation either, though that frustration would set in almost immediately. But at that moment in time, she felt a grave and seemingly never-ending amount of fury at Carol Hudson for knocking on her door and handing over a child without having the courage to say the words, "I slept with your husband." Carol had treated the betrayal of June's marriage as an afterthought, the smallest piece of the puzzle. She did not seem to care that she was not only handing June a child, but also breaking her heart. June narrowed her eyes as she thought of the unique combination of audacity and spinelessness that this woman possessed. Carol Hudson was a bold one indeed. June continued to watch Carol walk away while the two baby boys in June's arms started crying, in alternating tracks, as if refusing to be in unison. Carol backed out of the drive. Her clearly brand new Ford Fairlane was crammed to the roof with suitcases and bags. If June had any doubt, the image of a packed car made it clear that this was not a game. This woman was leaving Los Angeles, leaving her son in June's arms, leaving him for June to raise. Her back was turned, quite literally, to her flesh and blood. June watched Carol drive off until the car disappeared behind the curve of the mountains. She kept looking a while longer, willing the woman to turn around, to change her mind. When the car did not reappear, June's heart sank. June shut the door with her foot and guided Nina to the television. She tuned it to a rerun of My Friend Flicka in the hope that Nina would sit there quietly and watch. Nina did exactly as she was told. Even before the age of 2, she knew how to read a room. June laid Jay down in his crib and let him cry as she unwrapped Hudson from his swaddle. Hudson was small and puny, with long limbs he had not grown into, could not yet control. He was red and screaming, as if already angry. He knew he'd been abandoned, June was sure of it. He cried so hard and so loud for so long, so very, very long, that June thought she might lose her mind. His cry just kept repeating over and over like an alarm that never ceased. Tears started falling down his newborn face. A boy without a mother.
"You have to stop," June whispered to him, desperate and aching. "Sweet boy, you have to stop. You have to stop. You have to stop. Please, little baby, please, 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 for me."
And for the first time since they began this peculiar and unwelcome journey, Hudson Riva looked June right in the eye, as if realizing suddenly that he wasn't alone. It was then, June holding this strange boy in her hands, staring at him, trying to process just what exactly was happening to them both, that she understood everything was far more simple than she was making it. This boy needed someone to love him, and she could do that. That would be a very easy thing for her to do. She pulled him close to her, as close as she could, as close as she'd held her own babies the days they were born. She held him tight, and she put her cheek to his head, and she could feel him start to calm. And then, even before he was silent, June had already made up her mind.
"I will love you,"
June told him. And she did. Evening came around, and June took the chicken out of the oven and steamed the broccoli and fed Nina dinner. She rocked the boys, gave Nina a bath, and put all three of them to bed, a process that took a full 2.5 hours. And as she performed each one of these tasks, June was forming her plan. "I will kill him," she thought as she washed Nina's hair. "I will kill him," she thought as she changed Jay's diaper. "I will kill him," she thought as she gave Hudson a bottle. "But first, I will lock him out of the goddamn house." When the kids were asleep, Nina in her bed and the two boys sharing a crib, June poured herself a shot of vodka and threw it back. Then she poured herself one more. Finally, she called a 24-hour locksmith out of the Yellow Pages. She did not want Mick to step one foot in their house, did not want him to ever again sleep in their king-sized bed or brush his teeth in one of their master bathroom sinks. When the locksmith, a Mr. Dunbar, 60 years old in a black t-shirt and dungarees with yellowing blue eyes and wrinkles so deep you could lose your change in them, got there, June hit her first roadblock.
"I can't change the locks without an agreement from the master of the house," Mr. Dunbar said.
He frowned at June, as if she should know better.
"Please," June said, "for my family."
"Sorry, ma'am. I can't change the locks if the house isn't yours."
"The house is mine," she said.
"Well, not only yours," he said,
and June guessed his own wife might have locked him out of the house a time or two. June continued to plead to no avail, but the truth was she was only a little surprised. She was a woman, after all, living in a world created by men, and she had long known that assholes protect their own. They are faithful to no one, but surprisingly protective of each other.
"Good luck to you, Mrs. Riva. I'm sure it will all work out," he said as he left, having done nothing but extort a fee for being dragged out of his bed.
So June used the only tool she had at her disposal, a dining room chair. She lodged it underneath the knob of the front door and then sat on it. And for the first time in her life, she wished she were heavier. She wished she were broad and tall and stout, hefty and mighty. How silly of her to have worked so hard to stay trim and small this whole time. When Mick came home at 1 a.m. after recording, his collar undone, his eyes vaguely bloodshot, he found that the door would open a crack but budge no further.
"June,"
he said into the thin space between the door and the frame.
"The thing that upsets me the most," June said plainly, "is that I think I knew it already, that you weren't being faithful, but I put it out of my head because I trusted what you said more than I trusted myself."
"Honey, what are you talking about?"
"You have a third child," June said. "Your girlfriend dropped him off here with us. Apparently, she's not ready to be a mother."
Mick remained silent, and June found herself desperate for him to say something.
"Oh, Junie,"
he said finally. June could hear his voice give, as if he were about to cry. Mick fell to the ground, shaking his head and then burying it in his hands.
"Jesus," he thought, "how did it come to this?"
It had all felt so simple to him before Carol. He could have the beautiful house with the beautiful wife and the beautiful children. He could love them with all of his heart. He could be a good man. He had meant to be a good man. But women were flocking to him. Good God, you'd have had to see it to believe it. Backstage at his shows, especially when he was appearing on a bill with guys like Freddie Harp and Wilkes Topper, it was like Sodom and Gomorrah. June never understood that, the way the young girls looked up at him from below the stage with their big, bright eyes and knowing smiles, the way young women would sneak into his dressing room, their dresses open 2 buttons too far. He said no. He said no so many times. He'd let them get close or touch him. Once or twice, he'd even tasted the schnapps on their lips. And then he always said no. He would push their hands away. He would turn his head. He'd say, "You should go. I've got a wife at home." But every time he said no, He worried he was that much closer to the one day when he would say yes. And he wasn't quite sure when it had been, but sometime when Nina was still just a tiny little something, he realized he was saying no the way you decline a second helping of dessert. You say no while knowing that if it's offered one more time, you're going to say yes. That yes finally came in the parking lot of the recording studio during his first album. Her name was Diana. She was a 20-year-old redhead backup singer with a beauty mark drawn above her eyebrow and a smile that made you think she could see you naked through your suit. Heading home one night, Mick ran into her by his car, and she met and held his glance just a second too long. Before he caught himself, he was kissing her against the side of the building, pushing her up against the stucco, pushing his body against hers as if it would save them both. 7 minutes later, he was done. He pulled away from her, fixed his hair, and said, "Thanks." She smiled and said, "Anytime." And he knew in his bones he was going to do it again. The thing with Diana lasted for 2 whole weeks, and then he got bored. But he found that once it was over with Diana, the guilt made him want June more. He needed her love the same way he'd needed it when he first met her. He craved her acceptance, couldn't get enough of her big brown eyes. It was that much easier to cross the line a little while later with Betsy, the waitress at the bar across from his producer's office. And then there was Daniela, a cigarette girl in Reno. Just a one-time thing, it meant nothing. And what did it matter? He could still be a good husband to June. He could show up on time to every recording session. He could sell out crowds. He could charm the young and the old, wink at the old ladies who showed up with their husbands to have a good time listening to the hip young man. He was giving June everything they had dreamed of for themselves. They had their 2 sinks, and they were starting a great family, and anything June could think of, he would give her. He just had this one thing for himself. But then he met Carol. It was the Carols that ruined everything. And he'd known that. That's what was so maddening about it. He'd learned this all already watching his father. He'd met Carol at a show at the Hollywood Bowl. She'd been there with a studio executive. She was so tiny, but her attitude filled the room. She didn't want to be there, didn't even know who Mick was, a distinction that was becoming more and more rare. She shook his hand politely, and he smiled at her, his very best smile, and he watched the edges of her thin pink lips start to curl up ever so slightly, like she was trying hard to dislike him, but couldn't quite muster it. 40 minutes later, he had her right there in an unlocked limo they found behind the venue that night. Just before they both finished, she screamed his name. When they were done, she got up and left with little more than a "see you around." And 10 minutes later, she was back on the arm of the exec she came with, not giving him a second look. Mick was sunk. He needed to see her again. And again. He would call her agent's office. He showed up at her apartment. He could not get enough of her, could not help but be enchanted with her passive charm, her indifference to almost everything, including him. He could not get enough of the way she could talk to anyone about anything, but did not hang on a single person's word, even his. "Oh God," he thought a few weeks into it, "I'm falling." They had been seeing each other during late nights and long lunches for 3 months when Carol told Mick she was pregnant. They had run into each other at Ciro's. Mick had been having dinner with his producer. Carol was there with another man. Mick had lured her into the men's bathroom and taken her right there in the stall, so overcome with jealousy seeing her with someone else that he needed to own her. Afterward, as he smoothed his hair and prepared to leave the bathroom, Carol fixed her skirt and made herself presentable. Then she said, "I'm pregnant. It's yours." He looked up at her, hoping she was joking. It was clear she wasn't. And before Mick could say anything, she left him there alone. He closed his eyes and then opened them up to see his slack-jawed face staring back at him in the mirror. You fucking idiot. In an instant, he punched his own reflection, shattering the glass and cutting his hand open. He did not see Carol again after that night. He'd sent her money, but stopped calling her, forced himself to stop thinking of her, and he had not bedded another woman since then. Now here he was, nearly a year later, barricaded from his own house. But he'd known from the very moment he'd punched the mirror that this was looming. Maybe he'd known long before that, too. Maybe he'd always known he couldn't escape himself.
"Junie, I'm so sorry," Mick said, starting to cry.
It was so unbearable to hate yourself the way he hated himself just then.
"I tried to do the right thing, I swear."
June refused to be moved by the weak sound of his voice. It was not difficult for her to maintain her anger, but whenever she feared she might falter, she would think of herself being pregnant and retroactively change the memory, shading it with the knowledge that there had been another woman nearby carrying another one of her husband's children, almost as far along as she. How sad to not be the only one carrying your husband's child at that very moment. It seemed to June that privilege was the very least you could ask of a man.
"I was weak," Mick said, pleading with her. "It was a moment of weakness. I couldn't stop myself, but I am stronger now."
"I don't want you here," June said, undeterred. "I don't want you around these kids. I'd hate for these boys to grow up to be anything like you." She'd said boys, not boy, boys.
"Sweetheart," Mick said.
He saw it now, the way he could convince her to let him fix everything for all of them.
"I'm Hudson's father. If you want him, you have to take me too."
June and Mick were silent for a while after this, June unsure what to do. Mick waited with bated breath. There was no way she was going to allow a baby to be handed over to Mick. He didn't even know how to change a diaper. That baby needed June. That boy needed a mother. They both knew that. June opened the door. Mick fell into the house.
"Thank you,"
he said, as if she had granted him clemency.
"I will make this up to you. I will do right by you every moment from this day forward."
At just that moment, Mick looked up to see that Nina had woken and found them there.
"Hi, honey," he said to her.
From the bedroom, Jay and Hud started crying at the same time. June scooped up Nina and went to tend to her babies. Mick peeked over her shoulder, looking at the newborn son he was meeting for the first time. June was unable to bear it, witnessing Mick's connection to this child. She swatted him away, and he backed off. When she was done with the children, she went to the bedroom and saw that Mick had lain down on the far edge of the bed, as if the left side of it was still his.
"Junie, I love you," he said.
She said nothing in return. But as June looked at him, she felt fatigue take her down. He was not going to make it easy on her. He wasn't going to leave of his own will. He was going to make her scream it and shout it and force him to go. She was going to have to rage against him, and even then she might not win. Anger extracts such a toll, and suddenly June was so tired. She sighed, giving her body over to her breath. She could not fight him now, because she could not fight him now and win. And so, she lay down next to him, saving her indignation for daylight when she could think straight. All of this would still be there to fight in the morning. But in the morning, her anger had lost its edges. It had morphed into sorrow. She was now overtaken by the dull ache of grief, expansive and tender like a whole body bruise. She had lost the life she had believed she'd been granted. She was in mourning. So when Mick turned over and put his arm around her, she could not summon the energy to shrug it off.
"I promise you all of that is over,"
Mick whispered, tears forming in his eyes.
"I will never do anything to hurt you again.
I love you, Junie, with all of my heart. I'm so sorry.
And because June had not shrugged off his arm, Mick felt confident enough to kiss her neck. And because she had not shrugged off the small request, she did not know how to shrug off the larger one. And on it went. Small boundaries broken, snapped like tiny twigs, so many that June barely noticed he was coming for the whole tree. With every move Mick made, as he held her, as he kissed her, June lost sight of the exact moment to speak up and then resigned herself to the pain of having never spoken up at all. And soon, on the horizon, appeared a resolution, one that even June started to welcome, if for no other reason than needing the return of normalcy, even if it was a lie. At midnight the following night, Mick whispered sweet nothings into June's ear. June, despite herself, relished the feeling of his breath on her neck, and the two of them talked it through in the hurried and hushed tones reserved for secrets. Mick would be forever faithful, and they would raise Hud as one of theirs. They would intimate that Jay and Hud were twins. No one would dare question it. After all, they were about to enter another social stratum with Mick's second album. They would have new friends, new peers. They would be now a family of five. June felt that night as if she and Mick were mending their own broken bones together, laying the cast perfectly in the hope that one day she would not even remember she had been broken. And the crazy thing was that it worked. June loved her children, loved her older girl and her twin boys. She loved her house on the water and watching her kids play on the shore. She loved people stopping her at the market, two infants and a toddler in the cart, saying, "Aren't you Mick Riva's wife?" She liked the money and the Cadillac and the minks. She liked leaving the kids with her mother and putting on one of her smartest cocktail dresses and standing backstage for some of Mick's shows. She liked hearing "Warm June" on the radio and having Mick's attention when he was home. He always did make her feel like the only woman in the world, even when she knew for certain now, that she wasn't. So, despite the ulcers she was growing, June had to admit she could stomach it all more easily than she thought. Vodka helped. Unfortunately, Mick simply couldn't stop himself. There was Ruby, whom he met on the sunset lot, and then there was Joy, a friend of Ruby's. They meant nothing to him, and so he saw no real betrayal. But then Veronica. And oh my God, Veronica. Black hair, olive skin, green eyes, a body that set the standard for hourglasses. He'd fallen again, despite every attempt to keep his heart out of it. He fell for her crimson smile and the way she liked to make love in the open air. He fell for her slinky dresses and her sharp wit, for the way she refused to be intimidated by him, the way she made fun of him. He fell for just how famous she was getting, maybe more famous than him, when she starred in a hit domestic thriller called The Porch Swing. Her name was above the marquee in big, bold letters, and yet still, in the quiet of the night, it was his name she called out. He could not get enough of Veronica Lowe. And June knew exactly what was happening. When Mick didn't come home until 4 a.m, when Mick had a tiny trace of lipstick behind his ear, when Mick stopped kissing her good morning. Mick started having dinner with Veronica in public places. Sometimes he stopped coming home altogether. June had her hair done. She lost weight. She humbled herself to the level of asking her girlfriends for sex tips. She made his favorite roast beef. In the rare moments she held his attention, she tried to subtly remind him of the duty he had to his children. And still, he could not be torn away. Mick told himself he was nothing like his own father. His own father, who would come home smelling like other women's perfume. His own father, who would leave for weeks at a time. His own father, who would smack his mother for asking too many questions. He told himself he'd done right by marrying June, a woman nothing like his own mother, who would smack his father back. But he was lost in Veronica's hair, the way it smelled like vanilla. He was lost in her laugh. He was lost in her legs. He was lost. And then one night, when the boys were 10 and 11 months old, Mick came home at 4 in the morning. He was drunk, but he was unconfused. He bumped into his nightstand, pulling out his passport. The lamp crashed onto the floor. June woke up and saw him there, hair flopping in front of his face, eyes bloodshot, jacket draped over his arm. There was a suitcase in his hand.
"What's going on?"
she said. But she already knew. She knew the way people know they're about to be robbed, which is to say, acutely, right at the last second.
"I'm taking Veronica to Paris,"
he said, before he turned and left for the door. June chased him to the driveway in her sheer nightgown.
"You can't do this," she screamed. "You said you wouldn't do this."
She mortified herself, begging for something she never wanted to beg for.
"I can't be this person," Mick yelled at her. "Some family man or whatever it is you thought I was. I'm not. I've tried, all right? And I can't do it."
"Mick, no,"
June said as he shut the car door.
"Don't leave us."
But that's exactly what he did. June watched him back up the car, and then she crumpled down onto the driveway, heavy and dead, like an anchor tied to nothing. Mick drove away, headed to Veronica's house in the hills, where, he told himself, he could finally get things straight. With Veronica, he would do better. He was not a good man, not an honest man. It was how he was born, how he was raised, but a good woman could save him. He'd thought that was June, but now he understood it was Veronica. She was the answer. His love for her was strong enough to cure him. He'd call his kids once things settled down. Years from now, when they were old enough, they'd understand. June cried in her driveway for what felt like a lifetime. Cried for herself and her children. Cried because of how much of herself she had compromised in order to keep him. Cried because it had never been enough to make him stay. She cried because she was not surprised that he had left, only that it was happening now, in this moment, and not tomorrow, or a month from now, or 10 years from now. Her mother had been right. He had been too bold a choice, too handsome a man. Why were all of her mistakes that had been so hidden from her as she was making them so clear to her now? And then, for one brief second, she gasped and broke down, thinking of the fact that if he was truly gone, there might never be another man who could touch her the way he did. He took so much with him when he went. The sun started to rise, and June caught her breath. She walked back to the house, determined. She would not be shattered by this, not in front of her children. She walked into the kitchen and put 2 cold spoons on her eyelids, trying to reduce the puffiness. But when she caught a glimpse of herself in the side of the toaster, she looked just as frightful a mess as she'd feared. June poured herself a glass of orange juice and then popped the top of the vodka she kept in the cabinet and tossed that in too. She smoothed her hair, tried to summon the dregs of her dignity.
"Where'd Daddy go?"
Nina asked, standing in the doorway. "Your father doesn't know how a man's supposed to act," June said, walking past her. She grabbed Mick's albums off the record player and threw them into the trash, his cocksure face staring back up at her. She poured the rest of the carton of orange juice over it all.
"Wash your hands and get ready for breakfast."
June and her 3 children ate eggs and toast. She took them all down to the sand. They spent the day in the water. Nina showed June she could sing the alphabet all the way through. Jay and Hudson had both started pulling themselves up. Christina came by around lunchtime with tuna melts, and June pulled her aside.
He left, Mama, she said. He's gone. Christina closed her eyes and shook her head. He'll come back, honey, she said finally. And when he does, you'll have to decide what to do. June nodded, relieved. And if he doesn't? She asked. Her voice was small and she could barely stand to hear it. Then he doesn't, Christina said. And you have me and your father. June caught her breath. She looked at her children. Nina was building a sandcastle. Jay was about to eat a handful of sand. Hudson was sleeping under the umbrella. I will be more than just this, June thought to herself. I am more than just a woman he left. But when the lights went out that night, and all of them lay in their separate beds staring at the ceiling, June knew that she and Nina and Jay and Hudson all had lost something. They were now living with a different sized hole in each one of their four hearts. Noon. Nina stood in the packed kitchen as the three cooks managed the oversized grill and two fryers. She quietly began what was arguably her most important task at Riva's. She grabbed a few handfuls of fried clam strips, a bowl of cold shrimp, a bottle of tartar sauce, three slices of cheese, and four rolls. And she began making each one of her siblings what they all called the sandwich. It was a mess of cold seafood smushed between bread. One for each of them, hers with no cheese, Jay's with extra sauce, Hud's with no clams, Kit's with a lemon wedge. The sandwich didn't exist without Nina. When Nina was sick, she still went in and made the sandwich. When she was out of town on a shoot, no one ate the sandwich. It would never have occurred to Jay, Hud, or Kit to make the sandwich themselves, to make the sandwich for Nina. Nina didn't mind. She took care of her siblings, and they thanked her for it, loved her for it, and they all left it at that. When the sandwiches were done, Nina grabbed four red baskets and four pieces of parchment paper. She nestled each one in and filled the remaining space of the baskets with fries, except for hers, which she filled with salted sliced tomatoes. She checked her watch. Her brothers and sister were late.
Party tonight, right, girl?
Nina looked up to see Wendy coming into the kitchen. Wendy was an aspiring actress who took shifts at Riva's Seafood between driving into Hollywood for auditions. So far, Wendy had done a recurring role on a soap opera and been featured in a music video. Yeah, Nina said. She liked Wendy. Wendy showed up for all of her shifts, was kind to customers, and always remembered to clean the soda fountain.
Are you coming?
Wendy raised an eyebrow.
Do you honestly think I would miss it?
The Riva party is the one time of year that you truly never know what you'll end up doing. Nina rolled her eyes.
Oh, God, she said. You make it sound so rad, Wendy offered.
Nina laughed again.
Sure, rad. I'll be there, with bells on. I'm coming too, by the way, Ramon shouted from the fryer.
Nina laughed as she put the fried clams on each of the rolls.
I will believe it when I see it, she said to him.
Psh, he said, waving her off as he pulled two baskets of shrimp out of the fryer.
You know I've got a life. I can't go to some richy rich party, spend my time bumping elbows with some famous assholes. No offense.
I would expect nothing less than for you to decline my invite, Nina said. She was pretty sure Ramon was one of the only people who didn't consider being invited to the annual Riva party a perk of the job. Meanwhile, she was positive the kid currently manning one of the grills, Kyle Mannheim, a local surfer just out of high school, had taken the job this summer just to get the invite. She could practically sense his resignation coming next week.
Where are your good-for-nothing siblings? Ramon asked.
And just as he did, Kyle lit a grilled cheese on fire. The kitchen erupted in controlled chaos, and Nina put the baskets of sandwiches on a tray and slipped out. She made her way to the break room in the back. Nina sat down and picked a magazine up from the desk behind her. News Life.
She flipped through the pages. Reagan and Russian dissidents and MTV is ruining children and should she buy a video disc player? There were ads for the Chevy Malibu and Malibu coconut rum and Malibu musk body spray. Nina wondered for the millionth time why everyone outside of town thought the place evoked something exotic and preternaturally cool, as if it were a sun-bleached utopia. Sure, your neighbor might be in a few movies, but Malibu was a place to live, like any other. It was where you brushed your teeth and burned dinner and ran errands, just with a view of the Pacific. Someone should tell them all, Nina thought. Paradise doesn't exist. And then she turned the page and came face to face with her husband yet again. Bran Ran and Carrie Soto, love, love. Ugh, the tennis puns. Nina put the magazine down, disgusted. Then she picked it back up and read the article twice over. There were pictures of Brandon and Carrie together all over the pages. The two of them getting into a silver Porsche on Rodeo. The two of them walking into a country club in Bel Air. The photos haunted her. Not because Brandon looked happy with Carrie, although he did. And it also was not because he looked different with Carrie, although, again, this was true. Brandon had replaced his t-shirts with polo shirts, his boat shoes with loafers. But no. What haunted Nina was that this all just felt so familiar. She'd long ago watched her mother scour magazines filled with images of her father and his new wife. "We're here," Hud called to her before they even made their way through the door. Nina got up and hugged each one of her siblings as they joined her.
"Sorry we're late," Kit said.
"It's fine," Nina said.
"It was Jay's fault," Kit offered.
"We're barely late anyway," Jay said as he looked at the clock on the back wall. It was 12:23 p.m. The four of them sat down at the table, and Kit immediately started eating her fries. Nina knew they had to be cold by now, but appreciated that none of her siblings mentioned it.
"So what's up with the party?" Kit said, putting a fry in her mouth. "Do you need us to do anything?"
Nina picked up a slice of tomato. God, she wanted a fry.
"No,"
she said, shaking her head.
"It's all managed. I'm meeting the cleaning crew at the house in a few hours. The caterers will be showing up at 5. The bartenders should get there at 6, I think. Party's at 7, but people should start showing up around 7:30, I'd think. I have it all under control."
Jay shook his head.
"It's so different from the old days."
Hud laughed as he was chewing. He wiped his mouth and swallowed.
"You mean when Nina cleaned the house and Kit was putting out the bowls of pretzels? And you and I were convincing Hank Wegman at the liquor store to sell us 3 kegs?" Jay said. "Yeah, that's exactly what I mean."
"By the way, I'm mostly focused on beer and wine this year," Nina said. "I mean, obviously the bar will have a few bottles of liquor for cocktails, but I don't want to go crazy. I don't need somebody thinking it's a good idea to jump off my top balcony into the pool again."
"Oh my God," Kit said, laughing. "Jordan Walker's nose still looks terrible. Remember when we saw Pledge for Eternity? Every time he came on screen, it looked like he had silly putty on his face."
Hud laughed.
"But that wasn't because he had a whiskey," Jay said. "The guy was hopped up on mushrooms."
"Still," Nina said, "the caterer said beer and wine is cooler anyway."
"Yeah, all right," Jay said.
And then he briefly glanced at Hud, and in that nanosecond of time, they both knew they were going to drive down to the liquor store and stock the bar the way they wanted.
"Guys, what if Goldie comes this year?" Hud asked.
Jay shook his head. Nina smiled.
"Would you stop?" Kit said, laughing. "You can't call her Goldie. You don't even know her."
"I do know her."
"Standing behind someone in the grocery store is not knowing her. Just call her Goldie Hawn like the rest of us," Kit said.
"I lent her my basket," Hud said, "because her hands were full with her kids, and she said, 'Hi, I'm Goldie.'"
Nina, Jay, and Kit all looked at each other, trying to decide whether or not to give it to him.
"I haven't heard anything about Goldie Hawn coming," Nina said diplomatically. "But I do think Ted Travis is coming again."
Kit smiled and rubbed her hands together, excited.
"Yes!"
Ted Travis lived four streets over in a house built in the shape of a donut with a tiki bar and a grotto in the middle. Kit and her best friend, Vanessa, never missed an episode of his show, Cool Nights, about a cop in Orange County who slept with everyone's wives and solved murders wearing a blazer and swimming trunks.
He jumped two speedboats on water skis last week, and Van and I wanted to ask him about it.
Is Vanessa coming tonight? Nina asked. I know you said she might have to go to San Diego with her family.
No, she's coming, Kit said.
Vanessa had been in love with Hud since Kit and Vanessa were 13, so Kit knew she wasn't going to miss an opportunity to be near him. Kit kept hoping the crush would fade, but it never did. Hud didn't help matters by being so sweet to her.
But is anyone surprised Ted's coming? Jay said. He'd never miss an opportunity to come hit on Nina.
Nina rolled her eyes. Ted is like old enough to be our dad, she said, getting up from the table to grab a napkin off the counter. And anyway, I don't even want to think about getting hit on. I'm not sure I'm feeling my spunky best lately.
Oh, come on, Jay said.
Maybe just leave it, Hud offered.
You're gonna let some tennis asshole make you feel bad about yourself? Jay said, looking directly at Nina. The guy's a complete douchebag, and I'm sorry, but his backhand sucks, and I always thought that, even when I liked him.
I mean, Kit said, Jay's kind of right. Also, are we now allowed to acknowledge that he was balding?
The last part made Nina laugh. Hud caught her eye and laughed with her.
He really was balding, Nina said, which would have been fine if he realized it, but he had no clue. It was like right on top of his head, and he'd wear those visors.
That just made him look more bald, Jay said plainly. Why did you let him wear those visors?
I didn't know how to tell him he was balding.
Kit shook her head.
That is brutal. You let him walk out of the house and onto national TV with a bagel of hair on his head.
And they all started laughing, the four of them erupting at the image of Brandon Randall unknowingly balding on ESPN. They were good at this. They had experience. This was how they began the process of forgetting the people who turned their backs. At least it's Carrie Soto's problem now, Nina said. Let her find a way to tell him. The good thing about getting dumped by a dickhead is that you don't have to deal with the dickhead anymore. At least, that's how it's supposed to work.
1961. The day after Mick and June's divorce went through, Mick married Veronica. Within weeks, Mick and Veronica bought a penthouse apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and moved across the country. They had been married for 4 months before he started sleeping with the wife of a sound engineer he'd been working with, a redhead with blue eyes named Sandra. When Veronica figured it out, she'd found an auburn bobby pin in his suit jacket, she threw a dinner plate at him, and then two more.
Fuck, Ronnie! Mick screamed. Are you trying to kill me?
I hate you!
She screamed as she threw another one.
I hope you die! I really do!
Her aim was terrible. Not a single dish so much as grazed him. But he was startled by the violence of it, the flush of her cheeks, the craze in her eyes, the cacophony of dishes breaking and a woman screaming. The next morning, he had his lawyer file divorce papers. As he had movers pack his things, Veronica stood in her robe screaming at him, mascara running down her face.
You are an awful man, she cried. You were born a piece of shit, and you'll die a piece of shit, just like every other piece of shit on this planet.
When he told the movers to take the bedside lamp, she hit him across his back and scratched his shoulder.
Veronica, stop it, he said, as calmly as he could. Please.
She grabbed the lamp out of the mover's hand and threw it against the wall. Mick's pulse started to race as he watched her unravel. He grew nauseated and pale. She lunged at him, and he ducked from her last grasp as she fell to the floor crying. He threw a few $100 at the head mover and ran out of the apartment. As he lit a cigarette there on the street corner, about to hail a cab to his hotel, Mick thought fondly of June.
June learned about the divorce from the pages of Sub Rosa magazine. As she read the headline, she felt some semblance of pride. She'd lasted longer on the bull than Veronica had. Maybe, June thought, he'll get his head straight now. Maybe he'll at least call his kids. But the phone never rang. Not on Christmas, not on anyone's birthday. Never. Still, in the rare quiet moments backstage, in the deafeningly sober seconds before the first drink at his after parties, in the blindingly bright mornings before his first glass of bourbon, Mick thought of his children, Nina, Jay, and Hud. They would be fine, he figured. He had chosen a good mother for them. He had done that right. And he was paying the bills for all of them. He was keeping that roof over their heads, sending child support payments that were sky high. They would be fine. After all, he'd been fine with far less than they had. He gave no thought to the idea that he might break his children just as someone had broken him. Carlo and Anna Riva had been tall, stocky, formidable people. They had one child, Michael Dominic Riva, and had tried for more but came up empty. In other families, that might have meant Mick was the star, but for the Rivas, it meant Mick was the beginning of a failed project, one they were sometimes tempted to abandon. Carlo was an unremarkable barber. Anna was a mediocre cook. They often were not able to pay their rent or put anything that tasted good on the table. But they were in love, the kind of love that hurts. They hit highs so high, neither of them could quite stand it, and lows so low they weren't sure they'd survive them. They smacked each other on the face. They made love with a sense of urgency and mania. They locked each other out of the house. They threatened to call the cops on each other. Carlo was never faithful. Anna was never kind, and neither of them spent much time remembering there was a child. Once, when Mick was only 4 years old, Anna was making dinner when Carlo came home late smelling like perfume.
"I know exactly where you've been," Anna shouted, furious. "With the whore from the corner."
Tiny Mick ducked at the sound of her raised voice. He already knew when to find cover.
"Anna, mind your business," Carlo snapped.
Anna grabbed the pot of boiling water in front of her with both hands and flung it at her husband. The scorching water hit the kitchen floor and a spot across Carlo's neck. Mick watched from the living room floor as his father's skin began to puff at the collarbone.
"You crazy bitch!" Carlo screamed.
But by the time the burn had blistered, Carlo and Anna were snuggled up together on the tattered sofa, laughing and flirting as if they were alone. Mick watched them, eyes wide and staring, unworried they would see him gawking. They never looked at him when they got like this. The next month, Carlo was gone again. He'd met a blonde seamstress on the subway. He stopped coming home for 9 weeks. During times like those, when his father was gone, his mother could often be found alone in bed, crying. There were some mornings, far more often than to be called occasional, when Anna did not get out of bed until the sun had passed its zenith and started its way back around. On those mornings, Mick would wake up and wait for his mother to come to him. He would wait until 10 or 11, sometimes even 1, and then, understanding that it was one of those days, he would eventually begin to fend for himself. Anna would later open her bedroom door and join the world of the living, often to find her baby boy cross-legged on the floor, eating dried spaghetti. She would run to him and sweep him up in her arms, and she would say, "My boy, I'm so sorry. Let's get you something to eat." She would take him to the bakery, buy him every roll and donut he wanted. She would fill him with sugar, ply him with laughter. She would pick him up into her arms with glee, cradling him to her, calling out, my Michael, fast as a motorcycle," as she ran with him through the streets. People would stare, and that made it all the more fun.
"They don't know how to have a good time," Anna would tell her son. "They aren't special like us. We were born with magic in our hearts."
When they got home, Mick would have an ache in his stomach, and he would crash from the sugar and fall asleep in his mother's loving arms, until the chill settled into her again. Soon enough, Mick's father would come home, and the fighting would resume, and then they would lock themselves in their bedroom. But eventually, whether it was weeks or months or even a year, his father would leave again, and his mother would stay in bed. And Mick would have to fend for himself. Mick married again shortly after he divorced Veronica, the biggest star in Hollywood. It was a huge scandal, the talk of the town, when they had it annulled the next day. Nina saw the headlines in the grocery store while June was buying milk and bread. She couldn't read the words on the cover of the magazine, and June wasn't even sure if her daughter recognized the face of the man that was her own blood. After all, June had cleansed their home of his music and photos. She had changed the channel the few times his face invaded their TV screen. But still, Nina stared at the picture on the front of the magazine as if she could sense its importance. June picked up the stack of magazines and turned them around.
"Don't worry yourself with that garbage," she said, her voice steady. "Those people don't mean a thing."
June paid for her groceries and told herself she didn't care what he did anymore. Then she took the kids home and poured herself a sea breeze. Then came the spring of 1962. Mick was single and in Los Angeles for a show at the Greek, one of the last on his third world tour. In his dressing room backstage afterward, Mick loosened his tie and threw back his fifth Manhattan of the night.
"You ready to come out and play?" said his makeup girl with a glint in her eye.
Mick was already bored with her and he hadn't even touched her. He rolled his eyes and grabbed his drink. He was getting so sick of all the people around him all the time. And yet, he didn't want to find out what his soul had to say when he was by himself. And so he came out and charmed the VIPs and beauties who had made their way backstage. There were so many girls, so many women. For some reason, all of them seemed too easy lately. The way they clamored for their chance to hang on his arm, the way their makeup was all the same, their hair all sprayed in the same styles. Even their beauty seemed meaningless. What is one beautiful woman if you've slept with hundreds already? What does it matter if the pretty teenager in the corner is batting her eyes at you when you've had the world's most famous woman in your bed? Mick had started getting into the backs of his limos alone at night, drunk and already half asleep. The night after the Greek was no different, just him and his driver and a bottle of Seagram's. Mick rested his head against the window, watching Los Angeles whiz by as his driver sped farther toward the Beverly Wilshire. Mick was now drinking his whiskey right from the bottle. Perhaps it was the sights of his old city. Perhaps it was the smell in the air. Perhaps it was the reckoning that was emerging in his soul. But when he closed his eyes, June's face appeared in his mind. Round, wide-eyed, gentle. She was making him dinner, pouring him a drink, hugging the children. Beautiful, patient, kind. Things had been easier then, when he had relaxed into her, in their life together. However small and simple it was, she was a good woman. With her, he was as close as he got to being a good man.
"Let's go down to the 10,
he said to the driver, before realizing what he was even doing.
"The 10 to PCH, please, up to Malibu."
48 minutes later, he arrived at the front door of the first house he had ever owned, the home of the only woman he ever truly loved. June woke up to the sound of the waves crashing and someone pounding on the door. She put on her dressing gown. Somehow, she knew who it was before she turned the knob, but she couldn't quite believe it until she saw it. And then there he was at the threshold, in a stylish black suit with a white shirt and his thin black tie undone, hair tousled just so.
"Junie," he said, "I love you."
She stared at him, stunned.
"I love you,"
He shouted so loud she startled. She let him in, if only to get him to quiet down.
"Sit down," she said, gesturing to the dinette, the same vinyl chairs he had sat on before he'd left them almost 2 years ago.
"How did you get even more beautiful?"
he asked as he obeyed. June waved him away and brewed him some coffee.
"You are everything," he said.
"Yeah, well," June deadpanned, "you're a whole lot of nothing."
He had expected this. She had a right to be angry.
"What have I done with my life, June?" he said, his head in his hands. "I had you, and I ruined it. I ruined it because I got distracted by cheap women, women who don't hold a candle to you."
He looked up at her, his eyes watering.
"I had you. I had everything. And I gave it all away because I didn't know how to be the man I want to be."
June was not sure how to respond to the words she'd been dying to hear.
"I cannot live without you," he said,
realizing he had come here to get back what he'd lost.
"I cannot live without all of you, my family. I have been such an idiot, but I need you. I need you and our children. I need this family, Junie."
He got down onto his knees.
"I was sorry the moment I left you. I've been sorry ever since. I am so sorry."
June tried, desperately, to make the lump in her throat go away, to hold back the tears forming in her eyes. She did not want him to know how broken he had left her back then, just how desperate she felt now.
"Give me one chance to fix it all," he said. "I'm begging you."
He kissed her hand with humility and reverence, as if she alone could cure him.
"Take me back, Junie."
He looked so small to June then.
"Think of the life we could give the kids. The five of us, vacations in Hawaii and barbecues on the 4th of July. We could give them a childhood of everything you and I ever dreamed of for ourselves. Anything we can think up, we can give to these kids."
June felt a pinch in her heart, and Mick did too.
"Please," he said. "I love our children. I need our children."
He was picking the lock on her heart like a burglar at the front door. Almost, 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 and then,
"I'm ready to be the dad they need," he said.
Click. It slid open. June took his hand and closed her eyes. Mick kissed her on the cheek.
"Mick,"
she sighed. There, in her pajamas, Mick still in his suit, June moved her mouth toward his and let him kiss her. His lips were full and warm and tasted like home. When Mick pulled back to look at her, June looked away but took him by the hand. She led Mick into the bedroom. They fell to the bed as June pulled Mick onto her. They rushed as they clung to each other, their hearts swelling as they moved, their lips pressed against each other, their breath one breath. They both were under the same spell, that delicious delusion that they were the two most important souls to meet. This was what June had ached for every day since he left, the feeling of his attention on her, the way he moved his body with hers. He touched her in just the way she had grown desperate to be touched. Mick fell asleep soundly moments later, complete. June stayed awake the rest of the night, watching his chest move with his breath, watching his eyelids flutter. When morning came, she felt as if the next chapter of her life was starting, the part where the family lives happily ever after. As June started preparing breakfast, Nina woke up and walked into the kitchen. She could not quite make sense of the sight before her. Her mother was making eggs and toast for this strange man seated at the table. He was in trousers and an undershirt, drinking a cup of coffee. He looked eerily familiar, and yet she could not place him. She asked what she did not know.
"Hi,"
she said.
"Who are you?"
And Mick, undeterred, smiled at her and said,
"Hi, honey, it's Daddy. I had to go away for a little while. But I'm back now. Forever."
1 p.m.
Jay rolled up his trash and walked it over to the garbage can.
I have an idea, he said with a grand pause.
So spit it out, Kit said.
When was the last time we were all writing together? Like, actually, all of us, he asked.
So often now, things got in the way of the four of them just being out there on the water. Jay and Hud were traveling all over the world, and Nina was always on some shoot. But they were all here now. They all had the afternoon free.
I'm in,
Kit said. Hud nodded.
Me too, he said. Family shred.
Nina looked at her watch.
Let's do it. The waves are great at my place. We can head there, especially since I can't stay out too long. The cleaners are coming. I should be there to let them in, make sure they're all set.
Can't you just leave the door unlocked with a note? Jay asked.
No, I mean, you know, I should greet them, make them comfortable.
Make them comfortable? They are going to clean your house, Jay said. You are paying them to make you comfortable.
Jay, Nina started, but then that was it.
Are we gonna hit the surf or what?
Fuck yeah, we're gonna hit the surf,
Kit said, offering a high five to Hud, who took her up on it. The four of them cleaned up their lunch and said goodbye to the staff and made their way to their cars. It would be the last time they all surfed together. Even though Jay did not know what would happen over the course of the evening, did not know just what awaited them all, he did know that.
1962.
Mick's life came into focus for him during the summer of 1962. He was on hiatus from touring. His new record was already in the can, and he had moved back in with his family. Every day, he woke up with the satisfaction of being the man he meant to be. He was paying the bills and buying June and the kids whatever they wanted. He took June out for romantic dinners. He read stories of heroes and soldiers to his boys. Still, his daughter held a piece of herself back from him. Nina was not charmed by Mick like June was, and she was not aching for his presence quite like the boys. But Mick remained determined to win her over. He would tickle her in the living room and offer to sing her to sleep at night. He would make her cheeseburgers on the grill and make sandcastles for her on the beach. He knew, over time, she would soften. One day, he believed, Nina would come to understand that he was never leaving again.
Marry me, Junie. One more time, this time forever,
Mick said to June in the dark one night after they'd made love quietly as the rest of the house slept.
I thought last time was forever,
June said. She was half joking and still angry, but entirely happy to be asked.
I was a boy pretending to be a man when I married you the first time, but I am a man now. Things are different,
Mick said, pulling her toward him.
You know that, right?
Yes, June said. I do.
She'd seen it in the way he kept close to her, the way he never stayed out late, the way he drank half a pot of coffee in the morning to get up with the kids, and almost no booze at night.
Will you let this new man marry you?
He asked, pushing the hair away from her face. June smiled, despite herself, and gave him the answer that both of them knew was never really in doubt.
Yes, she said. I will.
That September, June and Mick remarried at the courthouse in Beverly Hills with the kids by their side. June wore a pale blue sheath dress with white gloves and three short strands of pearls around her neck. Mick wore his signature black. When the judge declared them married again, Mick grabbed June and dipped her, planting a kiss on her lips. Theo, Christina, and the kids watched as June laughed with her whole body, so delighted to have once again given him her soul.
Be the man you tried to tell us you were,
Christina said to him just after the ceremony.
I am that man now, Mick said. I promise you that. I promise to never hurt her like that again.
Them, Christina said. Never hurt them like that again.
Mick nodded.
Believe me, he said. I promise.
As the family walked out of the courthouse, Mick winked at Nina and grabbed her hand. She smiled just the tiniest bit in her lavender dress, so he lifted her up into his arms and ran with her through the parking lot.
"Nina, my Nina, cuter than a ballerina," he sang to her,
and when he put her down, she was laughing. Afterward, Mick and June did not leave for a honeymoon, but instead drove home to the beach. They said goodnight to Theo and Christina. June heated up a leftover casserole for dinner. Mick put the kids to bed. June took off her dress and hung it up in the closet in a plastic garment bag, dreaming of giving it to her daughter one day. It would be a physical testament to second chances. June was pregnant before the year was out, and by the time Catherine Elizabeth Riva was born, Mick had stayed for so long, been so doting, that he had even won over tiny little suspicious Nina.
"I don't remember now when you were gone," Nina said to him one night as he was putting her to bed before leaving to do a few kickoff shows in Palm Springs. His new album was about to be released. He was back in the spotlight. His publicity team was churning out the story of his redemption. Ladies man becomes family man. He was dressed up in his black suit. His hair was slicked back, showing his faint widow's peak. He smelled like Brill Cream.
"I don't remember it either, honey," Mick said, kissing her on the forehead. "And we don't ever have to worry about those things again."
"I love you this much,"
Nina said as she reached wide with both her arms. Mick tucked the blanket tight around her.
"I love you double that."
Nina was in it with all of her heart now, as only those who have been hurt